feels pretty cool, doesn't it, that on a January Friday night you can go out and have a little mini adventure, but you can still go out with friends and have such a great evening, even though it's bitterly cold. And it's not, yeah, maybe not a training ride or anything, but it's still so much fun.
So I'd just woken up in my hammock overlooking this frosty, twinkling clearing in the woodland, looking down over the city of Oxford, and you can hear us now starting to ride down into the city to start our ride for the day. But before we do that, I wanted to take you back to the night before when we were sat around the campfire, and it was a really incredible night, not only of, you know, shooting stars and this wonderful warmth amidst -2 degrees, but really actually quite deep conversation and some really deep belly laughs about just what it means when this adventure cycling goes to the extremes. So in part one of this episode, we spoke to Lachlan Morton, who rode GB Duro, which you could argue is one of the hardest endurance events in the UK, and also Miles Rezzo, who founded that event and the Racing Collective, which puts on a whole host of rides right across the UK throughout the year. We went for a ride with Miles around the fringes of Oxford on a very wet off-road route, in fact, and we were joined by Philippa Batty and Tom Probert, and they're the two that you're going to be hearing from in this episode.
Great sounds going on over here, by the way.
Hey, sound guy!
What sound,
sound
guy?
Hey, sound guy, there's a great sound going on.
We had some really fascinating conversations, not only about how they got into endurance cycling, both of them, but also some rather strange conversation about late night kebabs and fox paws, which will all be explained later on. So let's get back to the campfire.
Something's sizzling. Hi, my pretties.
Soggy good.
So Phil, it feels like you're a really well-established character in the endurance world, but where did it really start for you? Did you start on road or off, and how did you get into it?
Yeah, definitely started on road. Started commuting in London, really, about 9 years ago, and then a gradual upgrading of bikes as they either got stolen or I destroyed them. So maybe 4 or 5 bikes in, I then found myself finally buying a carbon road bike. So then distances were getting longer. And then I guess alongside that, I started doing tours on my own, going to Scotland and France, countries I was familiar with, but not really knowing what I was doing at all. So yeah, there were some sort of steep learning curves with solo touring. And then it was probably like 2.5 years ago that it was sort of tied in with quitting my then job, buying a new bike, a bike that I could sort of go anywhere on, gravel adventure bike, and then yeah, from there, well, I spent 3 months touring in Europe doing mostly road, but could also go off-road, do gravelly stuff. And then I'd always been aware of the ultra endurance scene. TCR was the, I was like, one day. Actually, when I went to go and buy my bike from Mason's, I said to Tom Mason, I said, one day I'd like to ride the TCR. And I could see him give me a look like, who are you? Anyway, I haven't ridden the TCR, I probably never will now. but yeah, I knew it was something that, I can't remember which film it was, but one of the films about either the Race Across America one or and I was just like, this is what I'm meant to do, you know, and something really resonates with you. It's not just a physical challenge, it's all of that looking after yourself and that whole mental game that you're playing, that it's a much more sort of holistic undertaking. So yeah, and then did the Transatlantic Way, which is like a road endurance race, which was great. Learnt loads, fucked up loads, and then a couple of months later got a sort of last minute place on the Silk Road, which I just thought I'd just dive right in. And I'd been doing more off-road from there. I think like having the right bike that means you're confident to just sort of take any path helps, because you're not scared of ending up on like the wrong shit, I'm on this track that I can't ride and I'm going to be walking for hours. It's quite nice that you can ride almost anything, even if you're really, you might be quite uncomfortable for a few kilometres. So, yeah. And now I just, I mean, I don't have a car, so my bike is my means of getting around. And so I do use roads because they are, you know, the quickest. But I don't like being on roads at all anymore. I've sort of, had a taste of the good life. And I just think, yeah, that when you're off road, there's something about being on a bike that makes you so much superior to someone being in a car, because you can go places they can't. And I think that's what's so much more exciting about the off-road riding.
Yeah, especially
is that you can get to places that you just couldn't otherwise, unless you're on foot or on a horse.
So tell me about some of those places that you can go on a bike but not in your car. Is it places that are local to you? Is it places in the south of Spain or on the Silk Road? You know, what places really stick in your mind?
I mean, actually Spain was, I cycled down through Spain. I spent about a month going from sort of Girona down to the south coast and following a route on bikepacking.com or parts of it. And that was probably my first real taste of like quite off-roady stuff. Mm. And that was just amazing. But that was also my first taste of longer term touring and wild camping and all those things. So it was just, and I just quit my job, so I've never felt so free in my life. And actually the like becoming comfortable with wild camping, that was the real liberating thing, because once you're comfortable with that and you've got a bike that you trust, like every day if you're confident in yourself and your kit and your abilities, then suddenly the world really is your oyster. When you're not limited by either trying to find accommodation or the roads that you feel like you need to be on, so that was pretty special, yeah. And I mean, yeah, Kyrgyzstan is just otherworldly in terms of landscapes. It's so so remote and so unpopulated, and it's, I think, sort of 60% of it is above 3,000 metres, so it's,
wow,
it's just all mountains. But actually, I mean, GB Giro and Scotland probably still is my favourite place in the world, because it can feel as remote as Kyrgyzstan almost. And it's actually only twice as populated as Kyrgyzstan.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, Scotland is the least populated country in Europe.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, and I think you feel,
and one of the
you really
wildest.
Feel that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And GB Giro is a sort of cross section through the country, or through all the countries. And because it felt like such a well built route, a well thought through route, none of it felt either gratuitous or, you know, just hard for the sake of being hard. It all sort of made sense, and and even though it's a very sort of renowned point to point, it was in no way anywhere near the usual route that someone would take when they're doing the Lands End to Donegal Road. So without sounding too cheesy, it really was about the journey. And not just, you know, getting to Jolly Grades.
Yeah.
You could, I think quite regularly people complete Land's End to Jonna Groats in as little as 4 days if they're really, really going some.
Yeah.
Yet GB Giro is, you're looking into double figures at least, right?
Yeah, well, Lachlan did it in, I think, like 7.5 days, and he's a pro cyclist.
Yeah.
So let's see if anyone can beat that.
So prior to taking on the Silk Road in Kyrgyzstan, what off-road experience did you have? And did you have any real practice rides or anything that stuck with you that really paved the way for your off-road career, as it were?
So I've mountain biked over the years. Me and some mates, we used every Easter we go to Wales for a weekend. So we go to like Coney Brennan or Afan, and I'd normally hire a bike and spend one weekend a year smashing it about on the trails, and I loved it. But other than that, and then all my mates bought me a mountain bike for my 30th birthday. Which has not been as used as it should be. so that was very much like trail centery stuff, which is quite different because that is just kind of going around in circles. And then maybe it was, I mean, part of the reason I wanted to go to Kyrgyzstan was just watching like the video. I was so drawn to it as a place, like the mountains, and I had my new mates, my new endurance mates who were there, and I was like, I want to go. And I still didn't have a job at this point, so I was kind of in a position where I could just bugger off for a month. And I think, yeah, spending a lot of time on one bike that was quite adaptable meant that I could skill up quite quickly on doing certain levels of terrain just by doing lots and lots of miles on what lots of people like to call my road bike, but it's not a road bike. It's a very versatile gravel bike. I don't know if I've just become more sensitive to it, but just how vulnerable you are as a cyclist on the road. And maybe it's partly with, like in London, I actually didn't feel vulnerable at all because generally all the traffic's moving so slowly, but being in the countryside and also like touring around Europe, you know, you just, a lot of the driving is really terrible. I heard a statistic recently that a cyclist gets killed every 40 hours in Italy. Oof. And they sort of describe it as, you know, when you cycle in Italy, you do take your life into your own hands. And I think, yeah, sometimes you feel that in like country roads around where I live. It's just, it's the speed cars go and how close they're willing to cut you that, and the sort of races that we're all interested in, you are putting yourself in a very like vulnerable position. So I guess, yeah, unless you're trying to get from A to B quickly, then why would you not just take the slightly bumpier, slower, almost definitely more beautiful route that is yours and you're not having to share it with cars? So yeah, I'm sort of feeling more and more strongly about that. But most of my experience with riding off-road has been through doing races because other people have like really thought about the routes, and then you're just following the line and you're getting to experience this thing that someone else has really thought about, which is why I quite like the fixed route events, because I'm a bit lazier when it comes to route planning. I just trust someone else to do it.
And you've had some really amazing results at races, whether it's here in the UK or further. Did you start participating in the races because you were competitive and you knew you really wanted to do well, or was it more a participation thing and just wanting to get involved?
I think there was just something that really drew them to me. It was the, like, this I do like spending a lot of time on my own. I'd go touring on my own. I was like cycling, self-supported, managing yourself. I was like, this is what I'm meant to do. And I thought, like, transatlantic, where I was like, I'm just going to rock up and do it. And you know, oh my god, like day three I was in pieces. I just thought, oh, I'm just going to be a natural at this. And I just made all the rookie errors. But yeah, you learn pretty quickly about how to, okay, so you really do have to look after yourself. You can't actually get away with like sleeping 2 hours a night. Well, I certainly couldn't. I am competitive, and I guess I like to challenge myself. And as I keep doing them, after last year, I said I wasn't going to do any this year because I just felt like they're too much. But already, I'm like, they are addictive, and there is this desire to do them and do them better. You just like. It is something about like doing something to the best of your ability, and at the end of it going, I did that as well as I could. Which I think you can translate to anything in life. Like, if you're going to do anything, why not just do it as best as you can? Because if you're doing it anyway, that's not to say I do, but because I also think doing them well is about enjoying them and not just doing them as fast as you can.
So would you say it's more about the personal challenge for you than about other people? Or are you still interested to see how you compare?
I mean, obviously it's like nice to see where you are, but like I don't really see any point in me seeing where I come in the women's rankings, because there tends to be so few women that if I'm the first woman in, that's just because, you know, a few of my like good female pals aren't in that race, and otherwise they would have, you know, they would have won it. But it's interesting to see, you know, to see where you come in the overall, because all the races you can see like what sort of percentage. They're like, oh, okay, I came, you know, in that like percentage. Mm. So that's.
And for some of these kind of races, even just finishing. I mean, I'm thinking about further right now, and a few others. Even just completion. Yeah. I say just completion is an incredible feat.
Further was just about proving Camille wrong. That was like a red rag to a bull. And he sort of looked at me and said, only five people are going to finish. And I was like, right. Challenge accepted.
So, how did you come to be involved with GB Giro as a concept?
I came along and did the Wales Giro.
So what's that one?
That was from Bangor to Cardiff, stopping at Das Farm midway, which is also CP1 for GB Giro. So that was actually my first sort of taste of the racing place. I've seen all the events. It was just, you know, a mixture of trying to get to the right places, having free time. And I did that one, it was just the best event. I mean, it was so, the route was amazing. There was 12 of us, like Daff's Farm, which is just the most magical place in the world. You know, this field in the middle of Wales with the friendliest Welshman he'll ever meet, who
and
just
his mum.
And his mum who brought me a hot chocolate in my bivvy. It was great. And I think it. The other woman there, she was doing Silk Road, and actually that's kind of what spurred me on to think, oh fuck it, should I see if I can get a place on Silk Road. In terms of people wanting to, there's actually been a few people, women getting in touch with me since last year, asking about GB Giro and asking like why do so many people scratch, and you know, and with sort of different concerns. And I said to them, go and do like some racing collective events, because they are just the best warm up for what to expect. And a lot of the worries are about wild camping and bivvying alone and all these things. And the terrain, it's like, if go and do something like this, and if you like it and you can bivvy in a, you know, a group like situation, and if you like that, then you'll, well, I'm not saying you'll love GB Giro, but you'll probably quite enjoy it.
Ease in gently, I guess, by doing these
get a taste
friendly
for it.
Events.
So then Miles got in touch after that, because we got to know each other on that, and basically said, do you want to be involved with sort of pulling this thing together and making it happen? And we sort of took it from there, where I guess I was a bit of a sort of sounding board. We kind of settled on the format, which was, took sort of strands from both of us of the sort of things that we enjoyed in races, which one of the main things is the stopping the clock at the checkpoints. So you can actually have that, time out, and actually have time to sort of debrief what you've just been through. And it did always feel like that. And I think almost everyone who did it said they really liked the format. And with all these races, by the end, the people that you're generally riding with throughout the event, because you'll generally be with similar people, you can feel very close to by the end. And I think what was quite nice about GB Giro was, because it kept bringing everyone back together, it could all friendships could grow. So it'll be interesting to see how it, if more people finish this year, because obviously the great thing about an inaugural event is lots of people don't know what to expect. So there's an element of whoever's on the start line will knows a bit more what they're getting themselves into. They will have watched the Lachlan's film, and so yeah.
You talked a lot about friendships and having the time to build those at the checkpoints of GB Giro. Did you find that getting together with like-minded people at the other events, like Wales Giro, really fostered that in terms of getting going on these rides with people who are into the same sorts of things with you, whether it was Silk Road Mountain Race or, you know, other aspirations that they had?
Yeah, it's like the last few years for me have been kind of huge in how I feel like my whole world has changed and the people in it. It was like this time last year that 2 years ago that I went on the Adventure Syndicate sort of cycling training get together in Girona, and like some of the people that I met on that are now, you know, some of my closest friends, and have just kind of opened like a whole world up to me. And then the people that I've met on races, and then you see it repeated races, and there is this you know, it's one of actually the really good things about social media is that you become friends with people via social media, and then you meet them or you meet up with them, like Elle, I'm gonna call it Elle McThunder Thighs. Because one day we were like, let's just actually meet up, yeah, rather than just commenting on each other's posts. We met up midway between where we live and we went for a ride.
Yeah.
And I think there is an amazing sense of community in this whole scene. And it really, yeah, you meet people from so many different walks of life and different ages. And there is just this thing that binds you all together. Even before you start the race, and then you do a race, and then at the end of it, you're like, we will always have this.
And what is that?
Well, it's knowing what you've just been through. like, I think further, you know, that was... that. I mean, that was quite... Well, no, they're all really unique experiences. And it is that kind of sharing of when that storm hit, where were you? And you're like, oh, I was on the top of the mountain, and I had to take shelter here, and... You know, and there's something really nice about that these very like elemental things, like huge storms, that everyone can then talk about. Or like in GB Giro, I think me, Tom, Andy and someone else all slept in the same woodshed in Scotland, but we didn't see each other. Yeah, like I was like, well, I left at about 3:30, and Tom was like, well, I got there at 4:00, and it was literally the only shelter. I think it was the penultimate night in Scotland, and it was blowing a hoolie, and there was no shelter anywhere, and we must have all just spotted this shed, and it was literally like an open-sided shed that the wind was just like blowing through, but you were like, yeah, and it is these things that sort of. Because it's a very intense experience that you just don't experience that sort of thing in daily life, this kind of sensory overload where the things that happen to you and that you experience and that you see, it is like life on like fast forward, that I think it sort of, I don't know, it like condenses and then also stretches time. So by the end, but when you get to the end of it, you really do feel like you've gone through something that is quite hard to, I don't know. I'm rambling.
Not at all. You say that it's very different to normal life, but do you find that going through these experiences, whether it's some immense challenge or, as you say, surviving the storm, does that affect how you feel in your normal day-to-day life?
I'm always really looking forward to going home or like having like routine and being... in my own bed each night, and you do really appreciate but it is the kind of the small things, the comforts having a warm house and a bed. Mm. I think you appreciate them more,
especially when you're camping outside on a January evening and it's 2 degrees. And you're all huddled around a fire.
Yeah, but then I was really looking forward to this tonight, and I was looking at the weather, I was like, whoa, -2, it's going to be really cold. And because, like I said earlier, I haven't actually slept outside since September. Because then it's almost like after a year of quite a lot of intense whatnot, you're like, oh, I don't need to go and sleep outside. I'm just going to sleep in my bed. But then it's nice when you're persuaded or there's a reason to go and do it, because you're always going to wake up, even if you are freezing and, you know, your water bottles are frozen, you're probably going to be so much more grateful that you slept outside than that you did in your own bed.
At least you'll appreciate your own bed the next night. That's what I find.
Exactly. It's just the contrast. And then after a while at home, I'm like itching to go and do a race again and feel that kind of, you know, that rawness of living.
I guess it comes back to what Miles was saying about it. It comes back to your very human needs about living every day to find out what you can eat and how far you can travel and when you can sleep. It's just basic things.
Really basic things. And there is something really nice about stripping your existence back to, you know, that just that, which is what we would have been doing, you know, I don't know, 1,000 years ago or thousands of years ago. We would have just been worrying about survival and also moving a lot, like, you know, as nomadic people. So maybe there is something you're sort of tapping back into actually what we're still more hardwired to be doing, which is just more about survival than comfort. And just constantly being faced with like unknowns and newness and excitement, because there is a weird thing about particularly I guess with the more privileged, that we do things that is kind of trying to like seek out pain or discomfort or suffering, depending on how you choose to look at these sort of events. But people doing, you know, marathons, ultra marathons, ultra cycling, which like earlier I was talking about people in trying to explain that to nomads in Kyrgyzstan. They're just like, well, why on earth would you do that? And I think trying to explain that to people 100 years ago who, because they would have all been doing manual labour, and it's a very hard thing to explain. But it feels like we're all seeking something that's been lost in like modern day society. Mm. So we're just trying to find it in other ways. Yeah.
Oof, sorry. That was really deep. I'm going to have to take a sip of whiskey, hang on.
Yeah, it's setting yourself up for discomfort and potential failure, which actually is 90% of the time it's highly unlikely that you will be that uncomfortable or fail or something really catastrophic will happen.
But then I'm sure you've got 101 examples of times where things have gone pear-shaped, whether it's some mechanical that you thought you'd never be able to fix, or you've run out of food, or gotten massively lost, and then you've managed to get over that.
Yeah.
And how does that feel?
Well, yeah, just it's that old, you know, nothing lasts forever, which is the highs and the lows. When you're feeling great, you've just got to remember that this will not last. Yeah. And when you're feeling shit, you know that you will be okay when either the sun comes out or you find a McDonald's or, you know...
Important question though, what is your McDonald's go-to?
Well, until I was going to say until just the cargo bike thing, I hadn't had McDonald's for like years, but actually that's not true. I was really hungover in Portugal after a wedding and I had a McDonald's in like a lovely seaside town where I should have been eating fish. I had a milkshake, Jenny Graham's advice, because it like settles your stomach, and it was like -2 outside. Ooh. and I kind of put this milkshake away and it just like freezed me from the core. So I wouldn't suggest that.
Maybe a hot chocolate next time.
And actually we all had vegan chicken burgers, and we were, and then one of them had bacon in it anyway, and then we were like, these are definitely chicken burgers.
Should we transfer over to Tom and quiz him a bit before it completely dies?
The man of five races.
Yeah. So Tom, you made it all the way up here with a huge rucksack of logs
Obviously, that's due to your massive training last year, including 5 endurance events. Talk us through those.
Yeah, I think I drew the short straw coming up here, carrying a huge bag of our firewood, which has done us proud tonight.
Oh, yes, needed it.
Last year I probably bit off a little more than was strictly advisable. I did sort of 5 big endurance races and a couple of other little ones just for good measure as well. I think it's a lot easier to sign up to things than it is to actually then do them,
yes,
carry them out in reality. And I think that's one of the nice things about becoming sort of part of the community and start making friends, you know, that put on events and getting to know people that are involved in these things, is that it becomes a lot easier to enter events,
get persuaded.
It's partly because people are egging you on to do it because you know a lot of other people that are racing and being involved in them, and also partly because when there's events where it's like your mates that are actually running them, and lots of your mates are involved in them, it's like, oh well, that'll be a nice fun thing, I'll just turn up and see all my friends, and you forget the reality of what it's going to be like, because I think the brain is quite good at filtering out the hard times and all the pain and the suffering and you know, remembering all the good stuff, which is a really nice thing once you've done the events, but it can sort of trick you into going back for more because you just forget how horrific it can be and how much suffering you go through. So you end up signing up to all these things and then you actually have to go and do them. So I did Transcontinental for the 3rd time last year, this time as a pair, so it was a slightly different experience, a whole new set of challenges and sort of experiences from that. Trans-Pyrenees as well, run by the same team, and that was the first edition of that, and I think again that's one of those little tricks where you're like, oh yeah, I'll sign up to that because it's the first, it's like the inaugural one, so that becomes your like reason to do it without thinking about it too much. Another first edition was GB Giro, which was probably, I'd say, the hardest one of all of them that I did. And then All Points North, which was a fantastic... In fact, that was the first one as well. It's a fantastic new event up based out of Sheffield, exploring all the lesser known northern sort of enclaves of the UK. And then one in France that I've done a couple of times, which nobody seems to know about because it's barely marketed or talked about, and it's just about kind of run, you know, it's like it's pretty loose, called Normandy Cat in Normandy, which is transcontinental format, so you have all these checkpoints, but actually you can do them in any order and going around Normandy. And we did a few of us did All Points North, and then immediately followed by Normandy Cat, which was like 2 days later, so we did one and then kind of travelled down the country, got the ferry over to France, and then started the one in Normandy.
Crikey.
Straight after. So we sort of like did back-to-back
little naps on the
races.
Ferry, and then off you go.
The sleeping on the ferry was a problem, actually. So we were lining up on the start line of Normandy Cat, I think 3 of us, and we were like, I don't know if this is a good idea. Like, I don't know if we're actually safe to be cycling here. I think we might be too tired to start this race at, you know, it started at like 10 o'clock at night. So everyone set off, the race started, and we just cycled straight to our hotel. Went to sleep for like 4 hours and then started again at 3 in the morning. So
incredible.
Yeah. That was interesting.
A wise decision, but I expect.
Yeah, definitely a wise decision. So, so I got through that year of cycling, and it was a fun thing for me to do, because I think part of the allure of when you get into doing these races, and the reason they're so addictive, is you get a little taste of like pretending to be an athlete to some extent, because you're like you're doing something that is in some ways you can sort of contort what you're doing to compare it to things that like pro athletes are doing, even though you're not doing it really at all to the same intensity and it's a completely different thing. But it gives you a little glimpse as an amateur sort of hobbyist as into the world of what it would be like to be a pro racer. So, you know, I'm there thinking, yeah, I've got this like season of races that I've put together, and you know, you're getting through this season. So it was kind of like a nice little it was a year of pretending to be like a pro in on the terms that I'm comfortable with.
But it's certainly not your first year of stacked races, and you've done a lot of travel around Europe and further on your bike. What was it that first got you into the long distance touring and then into off-road?
It's really through my family. It's through my dad, to be honest. We would always just go on bike rides as a family. And he would have a habit of kind of being a bit ambitious with what we were doing. So we would end up getting pushed a little bit further than probably you should strictly do as a parent. And so I remember quite a lot as a kid kind of just being absolutely destroyed on these like long multi-day rides. So the format of what I'm doing and what I've been doing last year and the last few years is actually something that the pattern was sort of set early on. And I remember one particular ride on the South Downs when I was like pretty young, I don't know, probably about 10 or something. We ended up having to sleep in a barn on these like hay bales because we couldn't get to our B&B that we'd like booked up in time because it was too far to get there, and we had to improvise, and we found this barn to sleep in, and it was just mind-blowing, you know, as a kid, because you're there, you know, under the supervision of your parent, and then suddenly you're just doing this mental thing outside of the normal parameters of life, where you're like, what, we're going to sleep in this barn? Just like, we didn't really have any like equipment or anything. And I think that's something that I still find amazing about these races and the whole sort of subculture that exists around it. And one of the really attractive parts of it is that it does just take you out of the patterns and the normality of normal life, and you're doing stuff that most people just aren't doing and just don't have any conception of, and it feels quite exciting and kind of important in a way to like try and subvert the normal rules of reality, where you're like, well, you know, yeah, that normally you have a day and then you get to the end of the day and then you sleep and then there's a new day that starts, but what if you just don't sleep and you just stay up, and then when does one day end and the next day start? And then suddenly you're existing in a whole different sort of reality where you're allowed to just go and sleep in someone's garage or like in a disused house or like outside of a shop or something. And yeah, you know, that's it's kind of escapism in a way, but within the real world, which is quite a potent thing to experience. So yeah, that's how that was the seed for the whole thing, really. And then
in a barn with your family.
Yeah, and I just thought like I just remember seeing the sun rising and being in this barn, and there was something that was like digging into my side, and there was like this disembodied fox's paw that I'd been sleeping on all night, and I was just like, whoa, that's mental. And I was just like, wow, this is like, people aren't really doing this stuff, you know. And
you've been sold on it ever since.
Yeah, well, it just stuck with me as like, yeah, this is what it's all about, you know. This is like, this feels real and kind of like important somehow. So, and I think it might be that thing about, you know, it's tapping into something primal and it's elemental and it's simple and it's you know, it's just you're stripping everything down to the basics. Suddenly I think you feel everything more because it's closer to the edge. It's closer to survival, and it's it matters a lot more when you're just pushed outside of your bubble of comfort.
And you say closer to the edge and away from comfort. What makes you want to go there?
I think, again, that's part of it, because I had these experiences with my family. So just personally, I'd got into cycling and realised it's something that I enjoyed. But basically all of my cycling experiences of long distance and touring were within the kind of comfort bubble of like doing it with my dad and like within a sort of little family group that felt really safe. And I was drawn to the racing aspect of it because it was taking that thing that I knew that I really enjoyed, but just pushing it to an extreme that was beyond something that I was doing with my family. So I needed to claim it for myself and to be like, okay, well, here's something that I really like doing, but what can I do in that's different to you know what I've been doing with my family, and then you know you want to see how much you can push that, and then you get into like, well, the real spirit of the whole competitive thing, which is the competition with yourself, really. And and then you want to, once you start to see what is possible, which is quite surprising actually, when you start doing things like riding through the night and depriving yourself of sleep, and you start to realize how far you can actually get yourself on your bike within say 24 hours and how little sleep you need, and then it becomes a case of like, you know, that's a natural progression of you want to push that to see how far that goes. I mean, it's a multi-layered, like multi-faceted thing. That's what's nice about it, because it's I think it's good and it's satisfying, and you get stuff out of it on multiple levels. So my personal kind of angle on it is the sense of self-sufficiency is very empowering, and you know that stuff is all you need to survive more or less indefinitely. You know, you can, as long as you're moving, you're keeping yourself warm, and you're also generating power with like your dynamo hub, so you can charge your things or your devices and things that you want. So as long as you can find food, then you can keep going, and it's just a really lovely feeling.
What's your go-to snack on the bike?
I really got into Oreos this year. Like, I went through a phase...
2019, the year of Oreos.
Yeah, I went through a phase where I was like, because I discovered that I'm quite sensitive to sugar and like blood sugar levels, and it's really important when you're trying to not fall asleep on a bike. If you have like an ice cream or something, you know, you feel great for maybe 20 minutes, half an hour, and then
the crash.
Blood sugar sort of crashes, and I would have to literally just stop and have a sleep sometimes once you're really like depleted of energy. So I really got into like, oh yeah, kind of like keto diet and really depriving myself of sugar and trying to like switch over to like fats and stuff. And then this year I was just like, actually, I'm just going to go full sugar. So yeah, Oreos are back on the menu.
And, excellent.
Yeah, it seemed to work okay, actually. They were great.
Because the first time that we met, Tom, we were doing Transkerno, which is like a little endurance event, a mini TCR, if you like, mini Transcontinental down in Cornwall.
Really
so you
fun.
Set off from Plymouth at 9 o'clock at night into the darkness. I think it's May Bank Holiday weekend. And there's 4 checkpoints across Cornwall.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I remember that was pretty much the first time that I'd ridden through the night.
Yeah.
And I was really struggling with keeping my eyes open because we rode through two consecutive nights, and with I think about 3 hours sleep in between. And the only thing that I could find to keep me awake during that time was chewing.
Yeah.
And it was Skittles. And my partner was literally force feeding me Skittles one at a time to keep me awake on this massive climb up to Launceston.
rationing them out so you can stay awake as long as possible.
I mean, I don't know how you do that for several weeks at a time. It worked for me for a weekend, but...
Yeah, well, that's the funny thing, isn't it? That that's another thing that you learn quite quickly, I think, is that nothing that happens is on a kind of steady graph. You know, like, you don't start off with 100% energy and then gradually lose energy throughout the event, no matter how long it is. Mm. You know, you go through these peaks and troughs, and it's weird. You know, you might feel really tired on day one, and actually you might feel the best you've ever felt in the whole thing coming into the last day, you know, when you've been
with the euphoria
racing for like
of nearly finishing
2 weeks. It's just you go through these kind of random cycles, so it's kind of it's the same thing really. Like, you might think, oh yeah, I struggled to get through a 2-day thing, how could you do that for a week or 2 weeks? But yeah, it just doesn't work like that somehow. Mm.
I don't know if you've ever found this, but this is just from personal experience, in that I think mentally I adjust to whatever event is coming up. So I remember doing my first 200K, and the last sort of 10%, so like the last 20K, were really, really hard.
Yeah.
And 2 weeks later, I did my first 300K, and again, the last 20% was really hard. But when I, going back 2 weeks, I was just about reaching 200K and I found that really hard. But the following time, 2 weeks later, that wasn't a problem at all. I feel like it's almost you set your expectations or your level at what that final goal is, and you only start to really suffer when you nearly reach that. I think that probably changes for these long events.
It's so
but
true.
It's such a mental game.
It's so true, and that shows, I think, what you're doing kind of behind the scenes in your mind, doesn't it? Because you won't realise it, but when you're, whatever event you're about to take on, you psych yourself up for that particular thing, and you know that that's the distance you've got to do.
Mm.
And I've definitely found that, you know, I've struggled more on, you know, a 100K ride and felt worse on that than kind of doing 300 or 400K, if you know that that's what you've got to do, and you're completely focused on it, and you do it, that can be easier. It's just, it's all about how you've almost like prepared yourself and conditioned your mind to do that. But a lot of the time, you're doing that without realizing it. Mm. I think.
Phil, what's your go-to snack on the bike?
Or
is it whatever you can get hold of?
Yeah, and it does change. I always set off thinking all I want is cashews and peanut M&Ms, and then by like the afternoon of the first day, I'm like, oh god, I never want to see a cashew again. I do like a late night curry.
Oh, you do like it.
Yeah, I love a late night curry or a kebab.
Outside
yeah.
What about a late night kebab?
Or a late night kebab.
I found they're actually surprisingly nutritious on bike tours.
Yeah. I'm always, because I think I do eat a lot of sugar on the bike, I'm like sweets and cakes, and so yeah, by the end of the day I'm like, just give me a kebab.
Well, you get a bit of salad, which I think, I don't know about you, but in my case, usually when I'm touring, it's just carb.
Yeah.
So actually getting some tomatoes, a nice bit of lettuce, a bit of onion.
And you can put half away and save it for breakfast.
You should ride over to Jason Donovan in Bristol.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's worth a tour, isn't it?
Maybe I can bivvy outside his van.
Oh, that's the best
first
name.
Customer. So thanks to Philippa and Tom for such amazing campfire conversation. And even after listening to all of those stories and weird and wonderful tales, if you're still feeling like this might be something that you could be tempted into, I would really, really recommend checking out the Racing Collective.
So they organise routes all over the UK throughout the year. Half of them are road, the other half are off-road, and it goes from everything from single day rides like Cotsduro, Oxduro, Penduro, right the way through to like multi-day rides like Walesduro, and then all the way up to GBduro, which of course is Land's End John O'Groats. You can't get much bigger than that in the UK. They're all really, really friendly. You literally just turn up and they're almost all free to ride, apart from GBduro, I think. So I hope to see you at one of those at some point this year. Now, if you want to do the Oxford route that we did in the last part of this episode, then of course that's in our Komoot profile. And there's also a link in there to the GBduro collections on Komoot. So these have loads of information about some of the highlights, sort of travel information, everything that you might need to go and ride them. And of course you could just pick off a stage or a couple of days rather than the whole thing, unless you're feeling very ambitious. And if you haven't used Komoot before, remember that you can get a free region by going to komoot.com/G. So that's K-O-M-O-O-T, and using the voucher code UNPAVED, all in capitals. We'll put all the instructions for that down in the show notes. And thanks to Komoot, we've also got the results of our giveaway for Brother in the Wild, which is a sort of weekend bikepacking festival, I think is probably the best way of putting it. So that they go to Imogen Sykes. So yeah, really excited about seeing you there, Imi.
Next week, we're talking to the Bicycle Academy, which is based in Frome in Somerset. And in the simplest sense, they are a place that you can go to learn about frame building, but it's kind of more than that. It's more about bicycle design overall. And Tom Sturdy there makes Sturdy Cycles and is one of the key parts of the team. And he's pushing frame building further than almost anybody else in the world at the moment. And so we sat down with Tom and talked about how with bigger clearances, one-by drive trains and a kind of variety of drop bars and flat bars and things are kind of influencing what you have to think about when it comes to making a bike. We also sat down with Jack Watney. And Jack, you met Jack a little while ago, didn't you?
Yeah, I think I first met Jack when he was working at the Raffa store nearby and some of the rides that he was leading, and just, you can't forget him. He's just one of those like incredibly enthusiastic characters who's just good fun to be around. And he sort of fell in love almost by accident, I think, with the Bicycle Academy, and the rest is history, which you'll hear.
And he had you doing a bit of work for him, didn't he?
Oh yeah, had a little brazing demo, which was really fun, actually, really good.
So listen to that one to hear how Catherine got on with a bit of brazing. You might have seen it on Instagram already.
So we're also going to be speaking to somebody who actually learned their craft and set up as a result of attending the Bicycle Academy. So Adeline Moreau has been a frame builder for a number of years now, also an incredible cyclocross and off-road racer and a very good friend of mine. She founded Mercury Bikes after learning at the Bicycle Academy, and we have a really good in-depth chat about some things that make the way that she builds frames a little bit differently, and actually what instigated her to start building frames in the way that she has done. And she's got some really interesting thoughts, I think, around making custom and unique geometry bikes accessible. So that's been a really interesting conversation, especially as it's something that I've been through myself, because she built my gravel bike for me last year, and also some very controversial points in there which are quite entertaining.
Well, in a way it's not a gravel bike.
Yeah, it's actually a cross bike. What's the expression? Brain fuck. So we hope you've enjoyed this episode. Do remember to share it with your mates if you enjoyed. We'd always appreciate that. Tag us in your routes and your photos using Unpaved Podcast on social media and Komoot. And until next time...
Thanks for listening.